Good afternoon. How's everybody doing? Ready to talk about some API docs? What? Come on. APIs are exciting, no? All right. See, I get the after lunch crash. That's okay, though. All right. Well, my name's Mallory Silva-Grondin, and I'm here today to tell you a story about a startup who used Madcap Flare to churn out a whole bunch of API documentation for the enterprise sphere. So just the agenda today, I'm going to talk a little bit about my background, because I always like it when folks come up here and tell me about where they come from, because, let's be honest, every tech writer has a different random story about how they got into technical writing. And then we're going to hop into my world, which is TraceLink, and what our API documentation looks like. And then I'll set some context in terms of enterprise systems and how that's worked for us at TraceLink. And then you're going to get the goodies, what I call the golden nuggets, which are how to not fail, because I already did, and I can tell you what not to do. Yeah, right. I like to help out that way, give a little back. And then give you some best practices as well. So I always like to get to know my audience a little bit. So how many folks in the room are either leads or managers of their documentation teams? Ah, yes, quite a few of you. Very good. How many of you have written API documentation before? Okay, about half of you. Very good. How many of you have written API documentation for SaaS or enterprise documentation? Very few of you. Oh, very good. Okay. So for my managers in the room, this is actually very, very, very much targeted towards you because I was the manager of the team when we cut all of these docs from scratch. And most of these are very much lessons learned from a management and strategic standpoint, including successes. And then for those that have either never written an API doc before or have, I'm going to go through some general best practices with that as well. So this is a little bit for everybody, depending on the lens that you're looking at. As I said, everyone has an origin story. So we're going to just start with mine so you can get to know me a little bit. So I've been 9 years in software. I did 2 in hardware at Kiva that was acquired by Amazon Robotics over on the East Coast. And basically my transition into tech was I was an academic nerd. And we have a company over in New England called EBSCO. And I had just graduated with my bachelor's degree and wanted to move on to my master's thesis in history and just be, you know, that poor college student that was never going to grow up. And then what I found out is I could work at EBSCO Industries in tech support, a more traditional 9-to-5 job that was better than my waitressing hours at the time, and that I could work on my thesis. And at EBSCO, I could get access to every piece of scholarly content on the planet. It was an academic stream. What I didn't expect was that I was going to get the tech bug, and I got it bad. So I went from technical support onto implementations. Their newest cash cow at the time, that's back in 2010, I think, was EBSCO Discovery Service. And they were looking for a new team of implementation project managers to take that product from implementation to execution. And what I found in that is that I did that through a lot of documentation, both internal and external, creating a lot of templates. A lot of our library holders, who were the key stakeholders at the time, they had massive and massive amounts of metadata in library holdings. We're talking Harvard University, BP International, really big institutions. In order to get all of that information, they needed templates. And so that was kind of my gateway into the technical documentation world. And with that, one of my former EBSCO colleagues had already kind of taken the plunge over to Kiva, which if those of you don't know Kiva, and I'm from the East Coast, they were an automated warehouse management system, or at least that's what Mick, our founder, would say. What everybody else would say is you're a robotics company, Mick, because we had these cute little orange robots that went going along. But that wasn't the brilliance of Kiva. It was the warehouse and algorithms and automation that we did. So I had a friend that went there and said, hey, you should come over and try this tech writing gig. And I said, what's a tech writing gig? She goes, what you've been doing all this time. I said, oh, okay. Well, is there a lot of code? No, there's no code. And I said, okay, I can handle that. No problem. So I started off as a contractor there, then went up to Tech Writer 2. And that was right amidst the acquisition from Amazon to Kiva. And during that 2 years, I learned a whole bunch. And I got more than just the tech bug there. I got the startup bug because I felt like I was just a hair too late at Kiva, that I missed something really special. I was seeing the camaraderie of those that had been around for a long time, since the beginning. The founders, the way they told their story. I said, gosh, I think I'm too late. I think I missed something magical. And then one of my former Kiva colleagues had already made the plunge to TraceLink. Networking is important. Keep that in mind. And my buddy Josh, who had worked with me at Kiva, said, you got to come over to TraceLink. I said, okay. He said, it was what Kiva was, but it's 3 to 5 years earlier. And I said, oh, fantastic. And there's a lot of overlap in terms of domain expertise here. We have supply chain. We have SaaS. We have people who I had worked with before. And it was a really interesting time for me to make a move. So I did take the plunge and have been now at TraceLink for over 4 years. And it was really a terrifying plunge because with Kiva, it was retail, it was supply chain. And in that world, it's pretty top to bottom. You manufacture, you ship, you get what you're looking for. Now I work in pharmaceutical supply chains, and that makes your head want to spin because it is not lateral by any means. And we'll get into that in a minute. So I took the plunge over to TraceLink, and I thought I was just going to really immerse myself in the world of APIs. They needed some API documentation stat. I had dabbled a little bit at Kiva, but it was mostly maintenance. I really wanted to cut something from scratch to really learn the best practices of the API world. Be careful what you ask for. So lo and behold, the company was growing. The team was growing exponentially. And my manager looked at me and said, so when are you going to tell me that you want to go into management? And I said, you're never going to hear me say that I want to go into management. She goes, okay, I just really think you'd be good at this. I said, no, I just want to sit in my little API world and write my little API docs. I think it was no later than a month later, she convinced me, and I went into management. But I was still writing a lot of the API docs. So much so that we started building out two teams underneath me. So we have the user advocacy, user interface documentations, and then we have the API documentation. And the APIs were really dominating, and I'll show you that in a little bit. So we've been going pretty well for 4 years. We've been running on agile sprints. It's funny because we actually implemented agile before the company implemented agile, and they looked to TechCom on how to do that successfully. We're not your usual story. This is why I love startups. Technical communications at TraceLink is one of the most valuable teams in the software company. Yeah, I expected to hear a pin drop there. Technical communications is one of the most valued teams at TraceLink. So much so that our CEO constantly demos our product analytics and our documentation. We are a 500-person international company. Now, when I got there, we were about 100. We're about over 500 now. And we have done that through very interesting ways. But it did all start with the API docs. And if you want to learn more about getting value and being seen as valued in your organization, that's a talk for another day. And I'm willing to sit down over a beer and have that conversation because it's a good one to have. But for that larger story, this is the one chapter, and it's the starting chapter, which is it started with the API documentation. And now what we're looking at now, I've insanely decided to take on the user experience team as well as of last week. So I'm moving up in the world of TraceLink. So new adventures there. So as I have these new adventures and pressures staring at me down, I'm actually looking forward to going back in time with you to tell this story. So I'm going to give you some quick stats and metrics regarding what's called our application integration documentation team. They were established in 2015 when we were still adoringly known as tech pubs. And we've always had about 2 to 3 writers on that team. We have 3 different types of API documentation. The typical, which is SOAP and REST. Most people that know API documentation know those protocols. They're everywhere. Where the niche is with TraceLink, because of pharmaceutical supply chain, is we have these things called asynchronous APIs. And yes, of course, you can have a SOAP call that runs asynchronously, but that's not what I'm talking about. I am talking about what's called asynchronous transactions. These are old school transactional data exchanging between an ERP system and another ERP system. And this is massive and massive amounts of data. This is not, I'm going to configure my mobile app to talk to Google so my customer knows where we are. That is not what this is. This is mountains and mountains of data. At TraceLink, we are exchanging billions of serial numbers down to a pill bottle every day. So we have massive amounts of data in these transactions and in the other calls. I'm going to show you how we manage that. Our audience is pretty typical to most API documentation, which is, you know, developers, IT specialists, BAs, product management. The typical, nothing too divergent there. And content, and this already grew since I flew out here because we had a release go out. But as of right now, we have 192 different messages across 22 API guides. And all of those come both in HTML5 and PDF format. And we do use global linking as our content management strategy. If we didn't, then we never would have got to that number in the course of 4 years. And the majority of that, I believe it was 125, 150, was done with 1.5 resources, 1.5 writers in the first 2 years. We were just churning it out as fast as humanly possible, which is how we got to be valued so much. I'll show you some of our metrics to see where we've gone here. So as I mentioned, we've had mostly API systems dominating the TraceLink network, and that's going to change. We have a lot of big things coming. I'm glad we're talking about micro content a lot at this conference because there's a lot of things we're going to be shifting around. But primarily TraceLink is a system-to-system business. So we are, and we began in 2009, really more on API-driven. It was really an API-first system. We had a UI, but nobody was really using it because of this mountains amount of data. Trying to plug these things in manually through a UI, it's so costly for those warehouses. It's so costly for the third-party logistics companies, right? So we were really API-driven, and you can see that kind of through our metrics here, where our online help was always a little bit less than until this past year when we started going in a slightly different direction. So our documentation, when we're looking at the analytics, our API documentation was dominating. And my CEO and my SVP, Lucy, loved it because they're the ones that developed it to begin with. And that's the best part of the startup, right? Which is these were the guys that sat down hour after hour, 90 hours a week, building up this company off of these messages. And when they finally saw their first PDF, which when we look at, I'm going to want to gag because it just looks awful, but they were so happy that, oh, we made it. We're a professional company now. We have real documentation, real API documentation, a real book we can give our developers to do this. They were elated and through the moon. And so with that kind of demand, the AID team just kind of kept dominating the user interface team, which was great. So, and you can see we have a lot of topics that we update across the year, over almost 3,000 topics alone. And it just keeps increasing because the products we have, they're maturing. They need maintenance. We also have a slew of new products coming out as well. So we have a lot of updates. Our maintenance is really our bread and butter right now, but we're still going strong with some new map work as well. Man, we were busy when I look at that. Yeah. Okay. Enterprise systems. So that's about us, right? And what we do is we document enterprise systems. What is an enterprise system? It's a B2B software package. A lot of what you read nowadays, both for user experience and for API, it's really consumer-driven stuff out there. A lot of really consumer-driven stuff. But when you're not working in a B2C situation, which most of us are not, you're working in a B2B situation, it completely changes the game. It changes the game from an experience level, and it changes the game from an API standpoint as well. So because of the complexity of these business operations, we have to think smarter. We have to think, what is the user really trying to do, and how can we help them if they fail, right? And these are really complex things. We have to trace a pill bottle that is packaged within a box that is then put on another box, which goes into a pallet. And by the way, we have to track all the hierarchical information there so we know exactly where it is. And then perhaps it gets exported from the U.S. and into China. And guess what? Our laws are different. We only have to track the lot in the United States, but we have to track at a serialized level, as in the smallest level, in China. And we have to gather all that data and report it up to the U.S. government and to the China government. And by the way, those handoffs with that pallet, there's going to be like 15 to 16 handoffs that have to be tracked and subsequently reported up again with, again, massive and massive amounts of data. So these are complex business processes, enterprise in the truest sense. Very, very akin to large businesses in other industries. So usually with these kind of businesses, you have enterprise resource planning. In an ERP system, is essentially an enterprise application. That's the easiest way to think about it, right? And business management software automates those processes that I'm talking about. Packing, commissioning a serial number to that bottle or to that box, right? Putting it on a pallet that then gets moved towards a truck. All of these things are business processes, and the business management software, specifically at TraceLink, and other customers' warehouse management systems help to automate some of that. Because if you can think about, you know, how slow that would go if it were all manual, nobody would be making any money. And I think we all know pharma makes more than enough money, right? Because they're automating. So essentially what needs to happen for these things all to work together is you have to integrate system applications to other system applications to exchange data. And how that works with TraceLink is either through your system or through your UI, you can plug in that data. And what we do is we process that data and we translate it into whatever the recipient wants to see it in. We have various different formats for that. So say you have an XML message coming in, okay, comes into TraceLink, and you have three trade partners that need to know that that shipment went out. But partner A wants it in XML, easy enough, no data translation needed. Partner B, wants it in EBCDIC 1.2 format, which is a GS1 standard. We can do that. TraceLink translates it, pops it out into that format. And let's say partner C just wants a typical CSV file. Easy peasy. We translate the mapping, boom, we pop it out. So one message can be translated however way we want. And our system handles that, right? We also do verification in there as well. So their system integrates into other systems, but TraceLink's value is that we translate those messages into whatever the recipient wants. And that's kind of the hallmark of what we do, right? So what makes good enterprise API documentation? Well, the first thing, and this goes for any documentation, is knowing who your audience is. And as we talked about, pretty typical audience for API docs, developers, business analysts, IT specialists, right? And the purpose is to integrate a system from end to end to exchange robust data. And I want to emphasize robust data, right? These aren't emails being exchanged. These are large files. I'm going to show you an example of one. Very, very large data files that need to be exchanged. And the type that we wrote up are technical reference, as most API documentation is. Any questions so far on what enterprise documentation is? I'm gonna jump into the cautionary tale. Yep. Startup carnage and how consistency is king. And when I talk about localization tomorrow, there's a byproduct of the story I have to tell, which is we were a startup, and I wanted that. Despite the 90-hour weeks for 2 years, I did want that. And I'm glad I did it. I learned more in 4 years than I've talked to some of my contemporaries that they've learned in 10 or 20 in the industry. A spectacular amount learned. So with a startup, though, there always comes carnage because it's hurry up and get it done. And then you don't always get to think all the things all the way through, right? You have to make tough choices. You have to make tough choices. And the biggest thing I can tell, if you take nothing else today away from this session, it's consistency is king when it comes to this amount of data that you are writing in your API documentation. Consistency is absolutely king. So I'm going to go through that story now. All right, so where'd we fail fast? That was the first API guide we ever made. It's gross. We've got the old try pane, right? This is before Flare had all those wonderful templates that they would offer us, right? We had to figure this out from scratch. We didn't have consistent messaging structure on the left TOC there. We didn't use any content reuse options. We assumed audience needs, and we'll talk about that in a second. And then it was triple-click access from the UI, which is a battle I'm still forging. But now that I own user experience, I'll win it more easily now. So in order to get to the API doc, you had to click into the help icon, and then you had to go into that help set to go to the API doc to then select an API guide. It's awful. So now we're just going to get it right from the footer, just where everybody else puts their API documentation, right in the footer, which is where it's going to go. Very excited for that release. Assuming audience needs. So as you can see, this is an HTML5 output. Our bosses can be a little scary sometimes, right? And within the 11th hour, and by 11th hour I mean 2 days out from the first release that this team has ever done, this was even before I was managing the team, my boss, who is like top 10 women in pharma, world known, right? I'm like terrified of her because she's brilliant at that point in time. And she goes, oh, but we need it in print. And we sit there and go, oh, my goodness. Nobody's done any print before out of Matt Kaffler on this team. There's three of us. We're like, okay, well, I guess we're going to have to figure out that PDF thing pretty quickly. So we assumed our audience's needs. We assumed wrongly, and this is why my management philosophy, number one rule is, never assume, is don't assume it. Get those requirements. The PMs probably thought they told you. They didn't, but then you get egg on your face, and then you end up working for 3 days straight to get those PDFs out, right? And that's exactly what happened. So the design part of it, we were just excited to get anything out the door, as was our C-suite, was, wow, we don't have to send gross Excel files anymore. We can have the guideline messaging and true error samples and XML samples all in one place. They had never had that before. In fact, they didn't have testing data or samples at all. So this was even a step up, right? And it's a story of iteration when you think of it that way. We didn't think about consistent message structure because we were just excited to get the first one out the door. And then we realized, oh, we have to do this 100 more times, right? We got to figure out that information architecture piece. And then we didn't think about content reuse either. There were no snippets in the original API guides, no variables, nothing crazy. We weren't fancy. It was bare bones. And then, of course, the access point and the audience needs. So if you're cutting API documentation from scratch, my biggest thing to say to you is, and if they're unsure, force the issue. How are they reading this? Because for this situation, they did need the PDF, because a lot of the business analysts weren't actually on their computer doing the development. They were gathering the requirements off the API guides. They weren't actually doing the development. That was a huge miss. And if we had known it, we probably would have gotten something a lot nicer out the door, right? So always, always, always know your audience needs. That's not just for API work. That's for any documentation that you're working on. But if you're especially in a startup where everybody's kind of, hurry up, let's get it all done, all hands in, don't forget to take a step back and to ask that question. And then thinking about consistency. So we had a pretty good information architecture there. We just didn't have it documented in our style guide yet because it didn't exist because we were a startup. So when we started going, oh, yeah, we got this, you start seeing deviations, right? So we want to make sure, you know, the architecture that was there was actually quite good. We just didn't do the proper knowledge transfer amongst the team to get that repeated, right? So that was where we failed on that point. Content reuse, there wasn't a need for it at the time, but I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So right off the bat, first time we do this, what was our successes? We had some failures. Some of them were, duh, you should have figured out your audience. Others of them were a little bit more, oh my goodness, we did not know that you needed a PDF. Wish I knew that yesterday, right? That's okay. These things happen, especially in a startup. Communication is flying a mile a minute. But despite that, because we use Flare, and I really want to emphasize this, Flare was super flexible, super adaptable, which is exactly what we needed at that point in time for the business's maturity. We didn't have time to tool around with other, I'll leave them nameless right now, other CMS tools. And when people tell me MadCat Flare can't be a CMS, I want to pull my hair out because we use it as such, right? We use it as such. And because of the flexibility of the tool, we were able to migrate a ton of technical debt from those Excel API guidelines, and that was roughly around 100 messages. We did that in 5 months, which is really something. 5 months, 100 messages. And we added context. These were just straight-up coding guidelines, right? Integer type, you know, length, quick description. Not going to work a trace link. The pharmaceutical supply chain is out of control. You need use case information. You need to know what messages you should be using as a developer and why. So we weren't just migrating the technical debt. We were adding additional context as well. And the error messages. So fun fact, and I hate to be such a technical nerd here, but typically when you have a SOAP or a REST message, you have guidelines or you have some sort of internal documentation. Not with mapping, not with transaction interfaces. What you have there is you have your input, the map input. That's cool. That looks a little bit like a typical SOAP REST call. Then you have the canonical, which is the whole thing that makes it work together. And in that canonical, you have error messages and validation. So you got to go pull that out. Then what you have is you have what's called adapter processing, which is the back end. So you have all these maps that are kind of independent. And then it hits the back end, and there's more validation and more errors that can come out, right? Then you finally have the full circle once you have those three things. But those sources were scattered everywhere at TraceLink. You had part of it with one team, another part of it with another team, and some of it didn't even exist. Like the Aerodox, they didn't exist at all. Exceptions were not anywhere. Nobody kept track of them. So what did we do? We migrated it. If somebody's going to use this document and they're going to go test the call they just made and they can't anticipate what those errors are that they get back, that costs them development time, big time, right? Easy access to XSCs. So these used to get emailed before we were around. We implemented a nice little link that I'll show you guys where basically, and we use Amazon Web Service, our XSCs are hosted up in their S3 bucket. All we have to do is relatively link to that behind the scenes. So the user comes in, clicks the XSD package, they have all their schemas right there for them. It's beautiful. And then, of course, we did end up ultimately hitting the deadline, because I've never missed a deadline, with the PDF options in tow. So that was our huge successes there. So we did think about some things, like the schemas and the errors, because without schemas, you can't develop anything anyway. We also had professional on-brand presentation. So at the time, again, these were... they were literally just emailing our customers and partners Excel sheets, and you know, they weren't the best written. They were written by developers. That's why we have jobs, right? Job security. So when the first guide went out, you know, both Shabir, the CEO, and Lucy were just super excited to see real documentation go out. And that's part of that value argument. If you're in a startup, those little things go a really long way. We're, oh, wow, we look like a big grown-up company now, you know? And we did shift it so that we had consistent information architecture so that these would be referenceable. All these applications have numerous messages in them, but you have to use the applications together in a mixed and matched sort of way. So even if you were in one of our applications, say our SOM application, but you also had your product tracking information, we wanted to make sure that if you're a developer developing both of those apps, you know exactly where to find everything. We have a release delta section. That's a best practice, and we thought about that up front, which is great, which is these things go through releases, and instead of having to read the release notes, which is a separate document, we put a nice little delta section right up front for them so that, hey, this field changed, this field's out, right? So we did think ahead on that front. We also added a feedback option, which was one of our very first scripts we put in Flare, where you have the little button that says submit feedback, and users, you know, submit their feedback. It goes to your tech pub's email, and you can address any questions or feedback there. The other thing is, and the guys at Mad Translations love us for this, and this is my OCD coming out, but it's proven to pay off. We had really clean file structures in that organizer. I mean, super pristine clean. Not only was the architecture very clear from a user's perspective, if I brought you into one API guide project in Flare, you could go navigate the other 50 that we have because it was repeatable. It's not just for your end user, it's for you. And when you're managing, it makes it easier to onboard newbies when everything is in the same place despite whatever the project they're in, right? So we planned for that up front as well. So those are some additional successes we thought about right up front that proved very fruitful. Then we went into enhancement style. Because I think I came here in 2017, looked at my buddy Patrick, who unfortunately couldn't be with us this time, and said, yeah, we can't. It's got to get a redesign. I can't look at this thing anymore. It's not pretty. It's not stealth. So what did we do? We enhanced everything. That includes enhancements in the HTML5 and the PDF output. And what we did this time is we went with audience-centric navigation. And this is an interesting one. And again, it's how you demonstrate value. We were somewhat documentation as a Band-Aid for a little while, a Band-Aid on the product. The product was not, we did not have roles-based access, and we did not have a way to have applications at the time that were geared directly towards one kind of customer. So if you are a pharmaceutical manufacturer, or you're a wholesale distributor, or you're a third-party logistics customer, the product itself did not allocate for that. We decided we wanted to give them a better experience. So what we did is we created this landing experience where you have the cart here, and you can pick who you are, and then it's going to tell you, oh, these are the messages that are for you. You don't have to think about anything else. You don't care about the pharmaceutical manufacturers. You don't care about the 3PLs. You're going to hit that CMO button, and you're going to see what applies only to you. And I'm going to demo that in a little bit. So the audience-centric navigation was huge, and that still to this day is our number one hit in the top 10 every year of most pages that are hit in our analytics. So that one was a big one. Consistent naming convention. So because I was talking about those formats, those systems, right, where we can take one format in and plop however many out, it was causing a very unruly TOC. So what we did is we used to go by message first, and then we'd have guidelines, errors, example, which is pretty standard. But instead what we did is we switched it up here, as you can see with these bold black, is we're like, you know what, let's go system first, because that's really what they want to know. What's the format we're doing this in? So we went system level architecture first, message, and then the guidelines, errors, examples. So it's rinse and repeat, as you can see here. It's the same over and over and over again. Very easy navigation, repeatable, and easier to translate that way. Then more enhancements. Snippets and global linking. All of the introductory content for all of our guides is identical, right? It's identical. So we have a, you know, a global linking project. All of our API projects pull that content in, right? So we only have to update it in one place and just pull it in, and we're good to go. It saved us a ton of time. I have a colleague out there that was using a different system that was trying to figure out how to do that, and it was really quite cumbersome for them. So I was pretty pumped with Flare with this capability. Enhanced use case content. Again, our industry really needed context. Our users really needed context. And it's a challenge as a tech writer, because we're supposed to be concise. And as you can see, me standing here rambling, I'm anything but concise, right? So the enhanced use case content, we kind of pushed back on that a little bit, because we're like, gosh, these guides are getting so big. But the reality is the customers wanted it. We talked to our services group. That's what they asked for. So for every single message that we had, we have a use case of why you would use this message, which has proven very, very fruitful as well. We also have started developing custom XML samples. Typically, the developers would just plop in XML samples and just put whatever data they wanted in there. We wanted more than that. We wanted to tell a story within the samples, and I highly recommend that. That's another one where, if I can say up front, if you're cutting one from scratch, insist on using the same data. It does help with the learning experience for development when they see the same data over here with that they saw over here on what they already developed. It helps them click in faster, especially when it's big data. Addition of tips and glossary, and then, of course, the one-click access that I'm very excited about that I talked to you guys about already. So the bottom line, these are the best practices. Okay? 100% non-negotiable, you need the coding guidelines, you need error messages, and you need test samples. If you want to be a rock star, make sure those test samples have the same data in them so they tell a story. Code can tell a story. It is possible. Be consistent with your user experience and your information architecture. Okay? Getting started in introductory content. Don't leave it. Don't leave it. Two reasons why. One, if you're going to explore writing it, you're actually going to understand how it works. I could stand up here for another 2 hours and tell you about TraceLink's integration system end-to-end, and I'm not a product manager or a trainer. You'll know it, and which means you'll know how to write it better. Okay? In addition, it's going to be helpful for your readers. Okay? I had a services person come up to me, ask me a question about the guide, and said, well, where's this for this? I'm like, well, it's in the error section. She goes, but nobody knows that. I said, Caitlin, it's in the introduction. Well, no one reads that. I said, well, they should. I said, it's a guide. I said, if you look at any other API guide on the face of the planet, there is a section that essentially says, in one way or another, this is how you use this guide. Right? She wasn't a developer. She figured that out quickly. We got on with it. But still, they should read the introductory content. And if somebody develops something wrong, because sometimes they'll try to blame your company for that, here's another gotcha. Ask them if they read the introduction. Most of them will say no. And then you're completely not liable. Yep. It's great. I love that. That section will get you out of trouble. They cannot read it, but that's going to be their own problem, right? Easily accessible XSDs, which again I'm going to demo in a second. They can't develop without the schema, right? Schemas, they take them, they load them into their tool. That's how they build stuff. Okay? Release information section, again, that's that delta. It's just a helpful trick. If you're a developer and you've already developed these, you don't want to go back to the entire message. You just want to see what was changed. That's all you want. Give them that delta. That's what they're looking for. Again, never assume. Mallory's number one leadership rule, never assume. And remember that print is not dead. I think that's a theme that we've been seeing a lot today. PDFs are still very much alive and well. I keep hearing tech writing's dead, and obviously look at all of us here. That's not true either. So just keep in mind, you know, HTML5 print. At this point, you know, user experience and what I call docx, doc experience, they're becoming very device agnostic. I feel the same way about HTML5 and PDF. There's ways you can do design in both with very minimal rework to make it work. So always think about print is not dead. Some of these developers are legitimately in a warehouse, and the internet connectivity is not always good. So they do actually print out the API guides to go develop locally in their areas. So it's knowing your it's knowing who you're writing to. You really, really, really got to think reader first. Who am I writing to? What are their surroundings? Because in some of these warehouses specifically, it was a bit of a learning curve for me. I was coming from Amazon Robotics. Our warehouses were fully automated. You have Disney-looking robots bringing you stuff. It was awesome. But in pharma, these are pretty low-tech by today's standards, and we didn't think about that in the first cut of the guide. We thought about it after, and it made a whole lot of sense. So those PDFs were essential, were absolutely essential. All right. I'm going to demo some stuff. Okay. All right. This is one of our guides. That's our interface. Don't look at that. It's kind of ugly right now. Okay. So this is the landing page I was telling you about. I'll do a refresh and make sure they don't bump me out here. Yeah. Say that again?
You put your version number right at the top, not as a footer?
That's correct. Yeah, and I can explain to why. So, we move fast in pharma. It was getting lost. We did some usability testing. It was getting too lost of which version am I supposed to be using? One company even said, we developed the wrong version. Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, that's cool. We'll just put it up where you definitely can't miss that. Was that the first thing you saw? That's good. Then it worked. That's good. Yeah, you can't miss it. And then we have revisions as well. It's funny, and that's why I love usability testing. Not to get on my user experience high horse. But something that would be industry trend, because we had that originally in the footer, as well as the build number, proved to be ineffective for our industry. Sometimes it's not a one-size-fits-all, right? So we had to course correct. Now, that was an easy one because those pull from variables, so it wasn't too bad. But it was an interesting find for sure. So this is our SOM application. Basically, our trade partners come in, and they need to develop some messaging out of this application. So let's say I am a CMO, and this, you know, we have the little carriage here. You know, you can keep picking. We have more than just that usually, but this one has just the three. So you click who you are, and you get brought to what is the use case page for CMOs. CMOs, by the way, are contract manufacturing operations. So say you have like a Pfizer. Everybody know who Pfizer is? Yes, large. Yes, large sounds good. Pfizer may actually contract out some of their manufacturing. That's a CMO. That's a CMO. All right, so on this use case page, what we have is we have exactly where you are in the supply chain. This is the whole supply chain for marketing, right? So you're at the CMO level. It explains your roles in the TraceLink network. And these are all of your messages that you may or may not want to develop. Now, in TraceLink, who you are on our network is super important. Because, of course, they wouldn't make it easy on me, right? If you are the person that bought the app, you are called the owner. You get to do whatever you want. If you are a partner to that owner in that app, you have very restrictive privileges. Usually it's typically just receiving or viewing. So if you're going to develop these, it did matter if you were a owner or a partner. So we had to separate that out. So, all right, I want to go with a big one. It's a weird angle to see it. So let's say I am a CMO. And I need to send a shipment, which is a very popular thing for CMOs to do. So it gives you a brief little use case there. And that's going to take you to the actual message overview. So these are the guidelines. What you see here is how much data it takes to exchange just a shipment. This is a significant amount of data. We had thought about chopping it up. Our customers went batty when we said that. They said, no, we don't. We want the whole thing. We're copying the whole table. Interesting. We said, okay, What if you didn't have to copy it, though? What if you could just download it? Because what they do with this is they edit it, and they load it back into their system. So that's one of our jQuery features. I think I had mentioned in the opening today that there is a kit I can give all of you with some jQuery plugins. I was a little tricky with my hiring. I hired a woman who was a front-end developer who had a BA, and I said, well, why don't you be a tech writer? She said, okay, and then she developed some awesome jQuerys for us. She loved it. So you hit that little download button, and now you have this thing right here. It's the same exact message, right? Obviously, you lose some formatting, but the developers don't care. What they care about is they can now copy and paste whatever they need to expedite their update to this message. It saved them hours of rework. Just that little download button. That's all it took. That's all it took. So that's one feature we wanted to call out, which we call export to Excel. So as you can see on the structure again, very repeatable structure here. And you could go to any API guide, it's going to say the same thing. You're going to have your TraceLink EBSYS standard, you have EBSYS 1.1 standard, EBSYS 1.2 standards, and all the messages that fall under those categories underneath it. And for each and every message, you have guidelines, examples, and errors. So I'll go to an example here. I think somebody else is demoing this right now. I don't know in what manner. But I know my eyesight's not fantastic, so when I'm dealing with code, I need those syntax highlights. This is pulling from Prettify, from the master sheet. So as you can see, the syntax highlights, that's something that Google offers for free. You just plug in the script right into your master sheet, make sure the master sheet's applied in your project. And you can, there's different kinds, too, so if you manipulate the URL, you can use different themes. We happen to like the black and the orange and the green because that's what our company colors are. And that's all you have to, you just have to do it once, apply the P tag, and you've got syntax highlights. Very easy stuff. Now, maybe that's not enough, right? Maybe you're like a developer, you want to copy that hierarchy because the hierarchy is identical. You don't want to cut it from scratch. But, you know, it's kind of not ideal to have to select all of it, right? So that's cool. You just copy it to clipboard. And then, I probably should have pulled up a notepad for this. Hang tight. Sorry, folks. Notepad. Text edit. All right. Pull this over here. Okay. So, I'll do it again just for fun's sake here. So, say I want to copy the whole thing. I hit the copy button. Go to whatever text editor you want. Hit paste. And it will all be there for you. Now, this is not my typical text editor, so excuse that. I got a new laptop last week. It was really bad timing. But it will keep hierarchically. And, again, it helps developers immensely because what they do is they copy it, paste it into their text editor, and then they put their data in it. Right? They don't have to cut the whole thing from scratch. Again, it saves them a couple hours. Saves them a couple hours. All right. So we got that's the copy to clipboard function. And then the XSDs, we're about to go through a redesign on these because I hate these icons, but it does the trick. So we have different levels of XSDs, and we have the PDF. So let's say I wanted to download the schema. Great, I just have to hit it, show in Finder, which popped up in front of me. Whoop. And there it goes. I can unzip it, load it up into my tooling. Easy peasy. Say I'm like, you know what, I need the PDF. That's fine. You can open that up too. Not a big deal. It's a big one. It's coming. It doesn't usually work this slow, but alas, because I'm demoing, that would happen. Come on now. I probably picked the biggest one there was. That's okay. It'll come. While we're waiting, any questions? There it is. See, the second I said it. So they can download this. Right? Table of contents. It's the exact same structure as in the HTML5. Again, designing device agnostic. Doesn't matter if it's print, doesn't matter if it's web, doesn't matter if it's mobile. Right? Same quick and easy referenceable structure. Overview content, how it works, diagrams, etc. And these are going through an enhancement right now as well, visually. So these will look very different as of next year. But here you go. So either which way. Yes, so that is the demo. How are we doing for time? We're doing pretty good, actually. All right. So that's just our story about a little startup that kind of hit their head a couple times, but got quite a few things right. To offer all of you stories of what not to do and features that will make your end users very happy, including the export to Excel, the copy to clipboard, making sure syntax highlights are in there. But of course, none of that matters if your content is not organized in a consistent and referenceable manner, right? In addition to making sure that that is, of course, accurate, right? So the last thing I'm going to tell you, I didn't put it on the slide, is that it is mandated a trace link that every document goes through the tech review with two SMEs, the product manager who designed it and either the developer or the user experience person that also designed it. We don't release these documents unless they have been approved by the two SMEs. That has been that way for 4 years. They're terrified of me if they miss their deadlines. I recommend doing that as well, especially because you're not the one that designed the API. It's going to be very difficult unless you go actually play with the API to see what is accurate and what is not. Sometimes that works if you have the bandwidth to do so. In a fast-paced environment like TraceLink, we don't. So we put that back on our SMEs. That is also the key to ensuring that your API documentation is 100% authentic as well. Because, again, it won't matter what it looked like. It doesn't matter what features you put in there if it's not accurate. Okay. Any other questions? Yes? Yes, help is context sensitive. So it is context sensitive to the screen, but not to the role. It's not role based, at least not yet.
So there's one click to select the role once you're in the help. How do you go to the context directly?
For the online help?
Yeah.
So to go to the help, I'll show you. How's that? Okay. Hopefully it won't work as slow as last time. Here we go. Okay, so, oops, wrong browser. If you're in the online help, I'm sure you all want to see my email. All right, I test. So let's say you're going into TraceLink. Log in. We're getting a new UI this year. Don't judge that UI. I did not have the team when that was built. All right, so let's say I want to go into one of my apps here, which is hard to see from the angle I'm standing at. So we'll go into SNX. Come on. Or SNM works, that's fine. All right. So now I'm in the SNM app. And I'm currently on the View Serial Number Templates page, which means I want to view my serial numbers. Let's say for whatever reason, I don't know how to use that. I click the little help button. And there is my help. Now, again, not role-based. It's tied to the screen. So despite what the system may pick up, it is not role-based because development has not had the bandwidth to do that. Yeah. Yep. They will because we're building a new platform, and it's a must. Yes. Very good. Yep. Yes, that is also jQuery. So the copy to clipboard that I showed you guys, the export to Excel, and there's a feedback button in there as well. Those are all jQueries. And if you're interested in me sending you what those are with instructions, just find me after. I'll be happy to email them over to you. I didn't write the instructions. I gave them a quick pass. One of my writers did it while I was on the plane. So it may not be perfect, but it worked for us. And we had, I think, 9 tech writers swarming getting this updated across our entire doc set in one sprint. So it was a pretty good toolkit because it worked for all of them. Yes.
Sounds like you're using Agile.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Oh, man, I don't have enough time to do that, but I will tell you this much. Come find me, too. I'm a huge Agile evangelist. There's that nasty myth that goes around that Agile is anti-documentation, and that is just simply not the case. We have proven that at TraceLink. We were the first team to do Agile and do it well. And what does that mean? It means sticking to the ceremonies. We meet for stand-up every day. We groom our backlogs, even if we don't want to, and we do it well, and we deliver. My teams, have never been late on a deadline in 4 years. Not once. And we release very frequently. We usually have at least a patch a week, and we do get impacted by those patches. If we didn't have Agile, and this is probably a different talk, they'd call me the Mal talk at work, by the way, is I don't think we would have survived as a team. Our Agile framework was our calm in the storm of a startup company, because when it feels so big and everything is coming a mile a minute, Agile is your safe haven because you're just looking here. And ironically, our velocities went through the roof. We over-delivered. Again, we're one of the most valued teams in the company, specifically in product management. We are the team people rely on. They come to us. A lot of my team was there before all of our new folks came in. They have product knowledge. They're asking questions. They're always willing to help, and they do it with a smile. And Agile is a huge part of that. Yes?
One of the big challenges we have is keeping up with breaking changes in the API from one version to the next. How do you guys handle that?
Yeah, we put that responsibility on the product manager. But they're not always a foolproof situation. So they're the product owner. If something is changing with their API in their product, they should know it. If they don't know it, and sometimes that happens because you find out in Scrum, I tell my guys, go be the technical communicator. Put your communicator hat on. Go tell the PM this is what's happening. Sometimes they know, sometimes they don't. That way you get the right people in the room to have the conversation, because the use case you're kind of talking about, right, of catching late-breaking changes, sometimes those late-breaking changes break other stuff. We do, but the product owner still needs to know that that happened. That's in our world, at least. They still need to know. Because we've found that when, for that exact example, something changed between release A and release B with how that API works. If it's not documented, if it's not on the product owner's radar, we probably have a problem. It happened to us recently. There was a config that got messed up, and that was not good. Let's just put it that way. Right? So when those changes are happening, if there's a developer making a change because of a bug or because of a patch, there has to be oversight on that. And TechCom needs to be included in those conversations. So what we do is we have one of our tech writers attend the sustaining or L3 scrums, because a lot of those that pop up, they're coming in through bugs. So that's where we catch those changes. But that's communication, which I could talk about for hours. It's all about communication. There are communication misses all over the map in tech. It goes too fast. What I tell my writers, even in the interview process, is you're not just coming here to write. You're coming here to herd cats with your communication style. If you think something fishy is going on, let me know. Let your PM know. Because most of the times they don't. And it's just because things are moving too fast. And it depends on where you're aligned. But your product team and your engineering team need to be aligned. And TechCom can be the voice of that alignment when it needs to be. Any other questions? Are we more excited about APIs? Less excited about APIs? I mean, talking about APIs after lunch, I was like, that's going to be a tough one, but okay. We can do that. Any questions about anything? Agile, startups, anything? Nothing's off the table. Very good. Thank you.